Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man with whom we have the privilege of talking frequently about an important front in that war, namely the home front, and specifically the threat posed to it by immigration, in fact, both legal and illegal, is Mark Krikorian. He is the executive director of an extraordinarily important organization in Washington, the Center for Immigration Studies. You can find his writings at National Review Online. He is the author of a very important book on this subject, The New Case Against Immigration, Both Legal and Illegal. It's wonderful to have him with us. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So I'm interested, Mark, in your thoughts on what now seems to be a concerted effort by the Republican leadership once again to use a deadline, namely Christmas, to jam through the Congress a piece of legislation that almost certainly would not be approved if it were a freestanding bill, namely to extend an amnesty, I guess is the best word for it, to the so-called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA folks that President Obama unconstitutionally accorded a legal status, and probably a lot of their relatives as well. What's going on with the Congress, and what should we on the outside be demanding of it?
Well, what's happening is these young people, there are 20s and 30s, they're not kids, but under this DACA program are people who came as kids and then grew up here. And it's the most sympathetic group of illegal immigrants. And that's why Obama, as you suggested, illegally used his authority to give them work permits. But it was just a temporary renewable thing. And because it wasn't statute, the next administration could and has pulled the plug on it. The president basically said the work permits would now start to turn into a pumpkin as of March. And so there's a push to give these 700,000 or 800,000 people who have work permits to give them a lawful amnesty instead of the unlawful one that Obama gave them. And so the push by the Democrats is to use that narrow DACA issue as a pretext for a much bigger amnesty that would cover maybe 2 or 3 million people. And unfortunately, there are a significant number of Republicans who are willing to go along with it. And they're using the end of the year as this kind of as a deadline to kind of create this moral panic to have to get this done. It looks like the Republican leadership is holding fast. Speaker Ryan, who on immigration is really not very good very often, he's clearly said this will not be in any of the funding bills, which are, you know, imperative to pass. I actually have hopes that the leadership is going to hold firm. The other question is, if they do pass even the narrow version of the amnesty, and look, I'm kind of a squish on this. I think it's an opportunity to pass that, but only if we actually get some important measures out of it, like ending the visa lottery, ending chain migrations, and mandatory use of the E-Verify online system for employers. So when they hire somebody, they actually check if they're really allowed to be here. Because otherwise, if you just give what the advocates are calling a clean amnesty, in other words, something without any balance or offsetting, you're just going to have more illegal immigrants that the very same people are going to say, well, we have to amnesty them too 5 years from now.
Mark, I'm struck by the fact that one of the things that Rosemary Jenks said on our program yesterday from Numbers USA should also be in that mix if there were to be any kind of consideration of such an amnesty is securing the border as well. That is, of course, a priority the president campaigned assiduously on. Should that be in the mix as well? And if not fully implemented, shouldn't it at the very least be something that is fairly far along before you turn on that magnet, as you say, for more illegal immigrants to come looking for amnesty of their own?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I didn't bring it up is because that's something we should be doing anyway. I mean, it's not even really as though this is something Congress needs to pass a law over. There's appropriations, there's money that the administration would need to do some of the things that they want to do, the wall specifically. They have authority and they have a certain amount of money to do a lot of these things, and they are. I mean, I'm not saying that things aren't getting done, but my point is to say that we have to have, you know, securing the border before we do these other things, to me, is like we should be doing securing the border even if there were no DACA issue or anything else.
I guess it gives new meaning to the term, it goes without saying, that we need to be securing the border. Mark, there have been some interesting changes in light of this most recent terrorist attack, this fellow by the name of Ulla up in New York City, putting a spotlight on some of the defective immigration practices that you mentioned a moment ago. I guess the uncle who brought him in through chain migration was himself a visa lottery winner. The Attorney General and the new Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security have both in recent days rather forcefully spoken out about the need for merit-based immigration. That is so commonsensical, and yet it seems as though it's controversial in the present environment. Talk to me about what is needed in that area.
Yeah, and this is an idea that's been floating around for a while. There's several pieces of legislation about it. And the basic point is twofold. First, we narrow the definition of family members who get special immigration rights. Because right now, the large majority of immigration is just people you're related to. So narrow it to husbands, wives, and little kids. Now, you know, no adult children, siblings, in-laws, that kind of stuff. Get rid of that. But also change the way that we pick the employment-based or skills-based immigrants, the other category, so that it does a better job of picking people who actually are likely to succeed and to benefit Americans, which is what immigration policy is supposed to be, and less likely to go wrong and become terrorists. The basic thinking here, this is the proposal the president has backed. There's legislation on this, is to clear out this red tape system we have now for skilled immigration. We do have one, but make it simpler. Use a point system like Canada does, where you basically just, you can do it yourself. You just enter in your age, your level of education, how much work experience, that kind of stuff, and it will give you kind of a score. And if you reach a certain threshold, you're then in the pool to be selected for immigrants. That way, we end up taking people who are the best of the best, rather than people who are just related to other immigrants, people who are picked at random. Our system now is just, it's almost hard to believe we even have such a ridiculous system.
It is indeed, let alone that we've allowed it to persist all of this time. Mark, let me ask you very quickly, finally, there is an idea that I, among others, have been promoting, including in an amicus brief before the Supreme Court, that when the president has talked about extreme vetting, at least one of the things that we ought to be vetting for is whether people embrace this supremacist Islamic doctrine known as Sharia, which calls for the destruction of our country, full stop. What are your thoughts about returning to the practice that we have used in the past to try to make sure that we weren't bringing in Nazis and communists to try to prevent, you know, more jihadists from coming in?
Yeah, I mean, it's long overdue. You know, we had some kind of ideological screening. In other words, even if you weren't a card-carrying member of the Communist Party or, you know, a member of the Gestapo, if you basically agreed with them, we didn't want you here. Well, the Cold War ended and Congress said, oh, okay, history is finished. History is over. We don't need this anymore. Well, you know, history came back. But it's important, I think, for us to point out that this isn't about keeping out people who simply identify as Muslims. This is where a lot of the public gets confused. The point is not, do you pray five times a day and do you believe Mohammed, you know, flew up from the Dome of the Rock? What matters is, what do you believe about this worldly conduct? And that's where ideological exclusion comes in. If you think it's okay to kill gays and to kill apostates, then I don't care whether or not you're a terrorist. We don't want you here. And that's the kind of testing that may not work much of the time, but at least we need to give it a try, both in order to screen out some of the people who might, you know, honestly say, well, sure, I think apostates should be beheaded, but also to send a message and set down a red line. These are things that are unacceptable in our society. And, you know, the sooner we do it, the better. We're moving in that direction, I think, a little bit under this administration, but we need to do it more comprehensively.
Mark Krikorian, thank you for your insights, as well as the superb work that you and your colleagues at the Center for Immigration Studies do. Check out his work, among other places, at National Review Online. Come back to us, sir, if you would, very soon. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. Next up, we'll talk with Fred Flights about the deep state, specifically in the Department of Justice and FBI, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Fred Flights, my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he serves as our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs. Fred is, of course, a career intelligence professional with an extended service to our country at the Central Intelligence Agency as an analyst, as the Chief of Staff to Ambassador John Bolton in the State Department, and as a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee. This is a wealth of experience that informs his great work, including a new paper we'll be speaking of momentarily with Fred about North Korea. Fred, let me just say welcome. It's good to have you with us, as always.
Good to be here.
Fred, before we get to North Korea, I did want to just get your thoughts in light of your long experience within the intelligence community, both as a practitioner and as an overseer on the staff of the Intelligence Committee, and I guess as a user in the Department of State, what you make of what I think can only be called the deep state that is now very much in evidence as a result of revelations about what has been going on within the FBI, apparently including the deputy director, Andrew McCabe, and this agent by the name of Peter Strzok, and in the Justice Department with senior level officials there, and sort of more generally, the National Security Council, the UN mission. I mean, it just goes on and on. It seems as though you really had kind of throughout the Obama administration, the Hillary Clinton campaign operating. And after all of that ended, it's now moved over and is now doing business as the special counsel investigating the President of the United States and his team. What do you make of all of this, Fred?
Frank, I've given a lot of thought to this, and you've probably heard liberal journalists saying that, look, it doesn't matter if thousands of emails were expressed criticizing President Trump or that some of these prosecutors may have attended Hillary Clinton's election party because they're entitled to their personal political views, and that's normal. And, you know, I understand that, but look, I worked at the CIA when I watched them actively trying to undermine two Republican presidents, President George H.W. Bush and President Reagan. I remember an editorial that the Wall Street Journal published in 2004 when President George W. Bush was seeking re-election entitled "The CIA Insurgency." It was all about leaks that were coming out to try to give the presidency to John Kerry. So when I see all this evidence of this political bias, I got to tell you, it does matter. It really does matter. And let me tell you something else real quick. I know two people who were nominated to senior positions through the State Department, and they told me they can't say anything pro-Trump in their meetings with State Department officials. The hostility is that thick. They've gone through briefings where they've been given statements and briefings by people from the Brookings Foundation that basically are promoting Islamists and talking down the positions of the president on the threat of radical Islam. So I don't want to make light of all this bias by the Mueller investigation, but it is crucial that the president get control of government by filling it with strong officials who will basically make these people understand that they have to keep politics out of their work and to understand this is an uphill battle when dealing with the deep state liberal bureaucracy.
But Fred, am I overstating the case to suggest that the deep state, in the respects that we've been discussing, actually is behaving in a manner that I think is tantamount to subversion? It is clearly at odds with the professional responsibilities in these various agencies, to say nothing of, you know, the democratic principle that you are there to serve the president of the United States, who's been duly empowered by the people of this country. When you see this fellow Strzok talking about in text messages to his mistress, no less, another FBI agent or official, that, you know, we need an insurance policy in case the American people actually elect this moron. I mean, it really smacks of sedition to me.
I agree. And it's not new. I've seen this through multiple administrations. I think the Trump administration thinks it's new because they're outsiders. They had no idea the incredible bias of the professional bureaucrats. When I was at the State Department working for John Bolton, some of these bureaucrats said, you know, our job is just to wait out these Republicans. They did not want to change any policies from the Clinton administration when George W. Bush was in office. There's a trend here. That's why we have to have very tough nominees put in place by the president to make sure that these people obey the law and obey regulations on doing non-political service to our country and not basically playing political games on the taxpayer's dime.
Well, I guess, Fred, the distinction I'm making, I know there have been differences in policy. As you know, I served in the Reagan administration. I saw it firsthand and have certainly talked with you over the years as you've been observing it. It does seem to me that there's a difference between disagreeing with policy and, you know, trying not to have it implemented and waiting out the politicals and the like. I think there's a qualitative difference, though, to taking steps that involve literally the impeachment of the president or the subverting of his legitimacy and his authority inside the government. I mean, that seems to me to be a horse of a different color, but maybe I'm old school on this, but it does need to be rooted out. You're absolutely right about that. And I would start with rooting it out of the so-called special counsel's office. Fred, now let me turn quickly to a very important paper that you've just published at the Center for Security Policy. It's an occasional paper, we call it. It explores, I think, in important ways, the challenge that we're currently facing from North Korea. You've studied this problem and indeed the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction more generally for years. You've studied particularly of late the Iran deal, the country that is joined at the hip, it seems, with North Korea. Tell us about your new paper and its findings.
Well, the paper, which was published today on the Center's website, securefreedom.org, is titled "Time is Running Out for the United States to Address the North Korean Nuclear Threat." And I go through the argument that, we can live with this because North Korea's nuclear and missile programs are a deterrent to stop a U.S. attack. I think a nation with such a large missile force, ICBM, submarine-launched missiles, over 60 nuclear weapons, H-bombs, this is not a defensive deterrent force. This is an offensive force that North Korea is eventually going to use. So I go through the deterrence arguments. I explain why they're not valid and why the president has to consider using at least a limited use of military force to try to change the dynamics of the North Korean conflict and make it clear that continuing to pursue these programs will mean the end of the Kim regime.
Well, and if we don't, I think is your point, it may well be the end of the United States. This is a point that I think cannot be overstated. We're looking at a North Korean regime that has, over time, with the complicity or at least the acquiescence of successive American administrations, Republican and Democratic, been allowed to get to a point where, as we discussed yesterday with Dr. Peter Pry, it could well take down our country, possibly with a single weapon, maybe one deployed in a satellite using electromagnetic pulse attack. So, Fred, this analysis of yours that a limited strike by us not only may be possible, but may be absolutely necessary, is a critical contribution to the debate, and I appreciate it tremendously. I think that it's most timely, and I certainly appreciate the work that went into it. Thank you for all the work you do for us at the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights. You can follow his writings at securefreedom.org. Check out in particular his superb book on the Iranian nuclear threat, Obama bomb, a great and growing national security fraud. Fred Flights, we'll talk with you again next week.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Rowan Scarborough, who is, by my lights at least, and I think that of most of official Washington, one of the best investigative reporters in the country, is with us to talk a bit about some of his recent reporting. He does that reporting as a national security reporter for the Washington Times. He is the author of two terrific books, Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage, the latter of which dealt with the CIA in previous times, but seems to be very much a term that should apply to what's going on at the moment, as we were talking about before the break with Fred Flights. It's a delight to have him back. Rowan, thank you so much for taking some time and for the incredibly important reporting that you've been doing on this Fusion GPS story, the dossier that they've spawned, and the various parties that are implicated in it. It's great to have a chance to talk with you about all of that and more. Welcome.
Hey, my pleasure, Frank.
You know, we need to start, I guess, with a little bit of a dramatis personae, as they say. There are several characters who have featured prominently. Again, we touched on this a bit with Fred, but Andrew McCabe as the deputy director of the FBI, and Peter Strzok, an FBI agent who's been in prominent roles in the counterintelligence business, figure prominently in all of this. But bring into it, if you would, Fusion GPS and what we know about these guys and their connections to that operation and what it did to produce a very, very dubious dossier, ostensibly about the candidate Trump.
Sure, Frank. What we have going on in Washington right now is a counter-investigation, sort of like counterintelligence. But now people are starting to look more and more into how did this investigation ever start and how is it being conducted? And the dossier is central because the writer of it, Christopher Steele, the former British spy, came to Washington twice to get the dossier and its charges inside the heads of very prominent, powerful news bureaus to get them to spread it around town. Now we're learning that he also had an in with the FBI, that he talked to the FBI on several occasions about ginning up an investigation into Donald Trump and his people. And then most recently, we learned he had an audience with the number four or five official at the Justice Department, Bruce Orr, and he met with him. At the same time, Bruce Orr's wife was investigating Trump at Fusion GPS.
Working on the dossier as well, or is that not quite clear?
Well, I'm sure she either working on it or trying to supplement it and add to it and explain it because she was a Russian expert. So, I mean, what else? She was investigating Trump along with Fusion. And the point I want to make, Frank, is that Steele money came from Hillary Clinton. The money didn't come from Fusion. It came from Hillary Clinton through a law firm to Fusion to Steele, who paid the Kremlin sources. So you had a Hillary Clinton paid operative coming into this country to spread false stories about Donald Trump with the Justice Department. That to me is just incredible. And I think if a Republican did that, we know what would happen, Frank.
Well, indeed we would. This reminds me of course, the dirty tricks that Hillary Clinton used to be investigating against Richard Nixon back in the Watergate days. The thing that's so stunning about this to me, Rowan, you've done a lot of great reporting on it, is that the deep state, in the person of Peter Strzok in particular, who's all over this story. I mean, it's just kind of unbelievable. It's beyond the dossier. It's beyond the Fusion GPS role. Victor Davis Hanson has a terrific sort of compendium of the various pieces of this story that he kind of turns up like, oh, I don't know, Forrest Gump or Zelig. And he's everywhere, including now, most recently, of course, in the special counsel's office. And I wonder whether you would agree with my characterization of what's been happening as we've learned more and more and more about what Bob Mueller has been doing, that it's kind of as though what was the Clinton campaign during the election of 2016, it's kind of now the Clinton campaign doing business as a kind of independent investigation prosecution arm at the moment. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, you can make that case, Frank. I mean, just as her agent was spinning up, ginning up the investigation to get them to do it, her loyalists then land in positions where they're doing the investigation. I mean, Strobe, and his lover, if you read their text messages, they were all behind Hillary, and they even talked very darkly about how do they what is the ultimate thing they have to do to prevent Trump from being president. And of course, part of this is at a time when Stroke was the lead FBI agent on the Hillary email investigation. Then he flips in July and becomes the lead FBI agent against Donald Trump. That, again, it's just absolutely incredible. And so he had to have had some interaction with Steele or with Steele's product. So we have a Steele-infected investigation then being carried out by Hillary prosecutors that donated to the Hillary Clinton campaign, such as Andrew Wiseman, who's one of the lead prosecutors, and then we have a loyalist in FBI agent Strzok. So the amount of conflict of interest is just striking.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Rowan, you've studied these kinds of things closely for a long time. You know, your specialty as a national security reporter is drawing out from sources information that helps expose both important insights and developments in the national security arena, but also wrongdoing. And I've never quite seen anything like this text in the exchange between Strzok and his mistress, where they talk about an insurance policy against Donald Trump's presidency. And apparently this was discussed with Andrew McCabe, the number two in the FBI. This is one of a number of pieces of evidence that Andrew McCabe has been deeply partisan and deeply hostile to President Trump and using his office in the FBI, as I think Comey was too, for partisan political purposes. Give us your take on this as a professional, you know, independent reporter and observer. How do you, you know, sort of view what we're seeing? Is it unprecedented, and is it really ominous for our republic?
I think that this is the deep state is being exposed more and more every day. We know that Obama's national security aides declared war on Trump during the campaign, and that has never been thoroughly investigated. But and so McCabe, deputy director of the FBI, has to be brought to the Hill for questioning about his discussions with Agent Stroke and what did they talk about in terms of trying to stop Donald Trump. Then you look at James Comey, who was the FBI director at the time. What did he do? Number one, he let Stroke rewrite the announcement to exonerate Hillary Clinton. He then put Stroke in charge of the Donald Trump investigation in July. He had to have known of Stroke's anti-Trump feelings. He had to have. Number three, we know Comey went to Trump Towers during the transition and briefed him on the most salacious things contained in that dossier. And about 15 minutes later, it's leaked to CNN. And all of a sudden, the dossier becomes a prime source for news stories, and it's posted by BuzzFeed with all its erroneous charges. And then we know, of course, ultimately that James Comey wrote memos to himself about Trump and then leaked them to the New York Times after he left.
For the purpose of getting a federal special prosecutor. And it turns out it was his pal, Bob Mueller. I mean, you can't make this stuff up, and it would make a great novel. But unfortunately, as you've been documenting, Rowan, at the Washington Times, it is all too true. And I'm not sure we've gotten to the bottom of it yet. I certainly second your call for a testimony from all of these characters before the Congress. And frankly, it seems to me it's high time that Bob Mueller himself be pulled up, because I think his own role in this and the partisan quality of his investigation definitely needs to be examined as well. We have to leave it at that, my friend. I appreciate so much your time and the great work you do at the Washington Times. Check out that reporting at washingtontimes.com. Rowan Scarborough's two books, again, are Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage. Required reading. Thanks, you, sir. We'll talk with you again soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a great privilege and high honor to have with us one of the most distinguished and, I think, extraordinary servicemen in our country's history. He is these days a retired four-star admiral, Admiral James Ace Lyons. But over the course of his some 36 years of service to our country, he rose through the ranks from able-bodied seaman to a four-star Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet. He's on the, and indeed chairs, the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee, and has been one of our most highly regarded and much sought-after contributors to this program. It's always a delight to catch up with him. Admiral Lyons, welcome back, sir.
It's nice to be back with you, Frank, and your audience.
Thank you. I wanted to catch you, Admiral, among other things, because I had a bracing and frankly, very depressing conversation recently with Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, United States Marine Corps, retired now with the Heritage Foundation, about a book that he edited there called the 2018 Index of U.S. Military Strength. And I know it wouldn't come as a surprise to you, but I think it would be shocking reading to most Americans to discover the deplorable condition of the United States military at the moment. He says that of the four services, two are rated as marginal in terms of their capability to perform their mission, and two are rated weak. This is appalling. There's a new piece of legislation, the National Defense Authorization Act, the president signed yesterday, but it goes a very, very short way toward remedying what ails the military. Your thoughts on all of that, sir, if I could.
Well, it goes back to the Budget Control Act that really cut the material readiness and capabilities of our forces dramatically. And never forget, this was an Obama initiative which had the desired effect of not only weakening, but almost dismantling our military forces to the point where we now have the smallest army since World War II, the smallest Navy since World War I, the smallest Air Force in its history, and the Marine Corps is suffering the same consequences. More importantly is the readiness of the active duty forces. The carrier air wings of the Navy are somewhere overall at about 30%. The deployed air wings are certainly in much better shape than that. But due to scarce material support and repair parts, that readiness is not where it should be, which should be around 90%. And those deployed carriers' air wings are probably somewhere around 80%. And that's the same for the Marine Air, which is at 30%, and the conditions where they're going into museums to find parts to repair active duty aircraft.
Yeah, this is insane. It is unconscionable. And the thing that I know must make you most furious, Admiral, is that what we're doing is not only imperiling our ability to perform vital missions for this country, but we're also imperiling, needlessly, the men and women in uniform who we're sending into harm's way to perform those missions because they don't have the kit they need. They don't have the readiness. They don't have the training. This is indeed unconscionable. Admiral, let me ask you about a further fillip to all of this. You have written extensively in your columns at the Washington Times. Specifically, you've talked about the impact on the United States military, the deleterious impact of the social engineering that was done notably during the Obama administration, but that unbelievably is continuing now under the Trump administration. Talk, if you would, in that connection most recently about this decision to begin the enlistment of transgender individuals in the armed forces.
Well, it makes absolutely no sense. As the lead psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University has stated, that transgenderism is a mental disorder. It needs treatment and understanding. It should never be forced on the military. And no matter how many operations you go through, you cannot change the original biological factor. But more than that, people forget it is, you know, the social engineering mandates that were forced on our military did absolutely nothing to improve readiness and our material or morale support. In fact, what they did, it was had the effect, unit integrity, cohesiveness, and the will to win. It did nothing to improve our readiness. It all should be canceled. And one other thing, Frank, people need to understand, it is the military that sets the standards for enlistment. Nobody has a right to serve in the military unless they meet those standards. The mission of the military is singular, to protect and defend this great country of ours, and if, when challenged, to win as quickly as possible. Anything that distracts from that mission must be rejected. That goes for certainly the transgender issue, for the don't ask, don't tell removal, which we've had reported in 2014. We've had over 12,000 unwanted male-on-male advances. None of this makes any sense. As I found out, there are three things aboard a ship you can never have. One's a thief, two's a drug user or a drug pusher, and three is a homosexual. And that includes the entire LGBT agenda. It adds nothing to the capabilities of the ship or our readiness.
And what is so infuriating to me as a non-military advocate for national security is the idea that you could have a federal judge telling the commander-in-chief, telling the Secretary of Defense, telling the United States military that their standards don't matter a damn, that they are going to take these people in, as you say, suggesting at least that they have a right to serve. That is not the case, needless to say. Admiral, we're talking about all of this as the world is becoming palpably more dangerous by the day. I was struck by the fact that Senator Lindsey Graham, who is seen by many as one of the leading lights on national security in the United States Senate, I've had my disagreements with him from time to time, but on this issue, he seems to have been reading your column. He said, we need to get the dependence, the United States military's dependence, out of South Korea, because they may well find themselves and actually be hostages in the kinds of threats that the North Koreans are currently posing to our South Korean allies and our troops there. Talk a little bit about the importance of that as you see it, and more broadly, the threat that is emanating from the North.
Well, as you know, in my op-ed, that's one of the things I recommended that we do, that we have to change the dynamics over there. What we're doing with the North Korean nuclear issue is we're only reacting. And when you face an adversary, you have to retain the initiative. You have to keep them off balance. You want them to react to you, not you always reacting to them. And in this case, I said one of the first ways to change the dynamics is to withdraw all U.S. military dependence from South Korea. Right now, they're acting as a hostage for us, and it sends the signal that we're really not going to take any action at all.
Well, a signal that was very powerfully telegraphed, of course, yesterday by the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, that we're desperate to negotiate with the North Koreans, even to just talk about the weather, whatever they want to do. Bad diplomacy, it seems. Admiral Ace Lyons, I thank you so much for your time, your incredible and continuing service to our country, most especially that you're rendering as the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Military Committee. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon, sir. In the meantime, a Merry Christmas to you. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.